He has since learned that Betty has no problem with his being the head of the home as long as she gets to be the neck that turns the head. And he gets to make all the major decisions, like what America should do in Haiti. And she gets to make all the other little decisions, like what to do with their money and where they'll live and spend their vacation. Yes, I was going to mention this morning that 2 weeks ago, our first girl made me a grandfather. And I'm not sure that I'm ready to be called a grandfather. I'm ready to enjoy all the pleasures of grandparenting. But somehow, you know, grandpa, grandfather, that seems like a title that should stay with my father. That's what other people call him. And we're looking forward to it. But I'm afraid that this little boy, who has since put on a pound, he's now up to 10 pounds, and put on an inch, my wife told me this morning. They're living in Germany, and so we call them and find out how things are developing there. A friend last week, when I was in Canada, shared some things with me that I'll probably have to pass on to him to help him realize that he lives in a woman world, in a woman's world. And he made some observations, and you probably have noticed that when a man is born, they ask, how is the mother? And when a man marries, they say, what a beautiful bride. And when a man dies, they ask, how much did he leave her? So the world in which we live. Our subject this morning is loving people. And last year, about the time I was to bring this series of message in Heston, I ran across an article in USA Today. And I'll only read a section of it. It says, in a me-first society, being nice for no reason is a revolutionary act. So Gavin Whitsett has become a leader of what he sees as an underground movement. Whitsett says he always considered it great fun to amuse and confuse strangers by paying the toll of the car behind him or dropping a coupon for a free car wash into somebody's grocery basket. Then one day he saw a bumper sticker that said, practice random acts of kindness. It struck me as a kind of guerrilla type approach to doing good work, said Whitsett. What makes things like this so unusual and so surprising in our society is that we're just not a people who are accustomed to loving others. Society doesn't expect it. And this whole idea of loving people is a revolutionary thought. And perhaps you feel like the one who says, mankind I love. It's people I can't get along with. Several years ago, after college, I was working temporarily at an appliance store in Jamaica. I was in between, just helped out in a Leighton Ford crusade, and I was waiting for my next assignment with the navigators. And I'd gotten to know this older couple. I think they were from Scotland, during the crusade when I helped to teach classes. And one day they came by the store, and we were talking, and as they were leaving, they shared with me this little ditty. It says, to live in heaven above with those we love, indeed, that will be glory. To live on earth below with those we know, well, that's another story. Jesus said the second greatest commandment, or the second most important commandment, or the second highest priority in life, is to love your neighbor as yourself. This is a natural outflow of our love for God, isn't it? And John wrote about this in 1 John 4:20 and 21, when he says that anyone who does not love his brother whom he has seen cannot love God whom he has not seen. Think about that. It says, anyone who does not love his brother whom he has seen, you cannot love God whom you have not seen. And he went on to say that God gave us a commandment that says, whoever loves God must also love his brother. There's no option. It's not that I can choose to love God, but I can choose over here whether I'm going to love people. Mother Teresa, I mentioned her on Monday, and she's one of my heroes, made the comment that because we cannot see Christ, we cannot express our love to him. But our neighbors, we can always see, and we can do for them what, if we saw Jesus Christ, we would like to do for him. So you think of it in that light. That loving my neighbor, whom I can see, is a way of doing for Jesus Christ, which if I could see him, I would do for him. And Jesus says, do it for them. Do it to the least of my brethren. The Apostle Paul, in epistle after epistle, letter after letter, teaches, challenges, inspires, affirms, reminds the believers to live a life of love for others. You know that passage in 1 Corinthians 13 and how he wrote to emphasize the importance of having love in our lives and being people of love. I'll just read the first three verses. If I speak in the tongues of men and of angels, but have not love, I'm only a sounding gong or a clanging cymbal. If I have the gift of prophecy and can fathom all mysteries and all knowledge, and if I have a faith that can move mountains, but have not love, I am nothing. If I give all I possess to the poor, and surrender my body to the flames, but have not love, I gain nothing. And to the Galatian believers, he wrote as they were going through this confusion of do they need to keep the Jewish laws and ceremonial laws and all the rituals to be truly saved and to have eternal life? And he clarified that for them. And in Galatians 5:6, he says, you know, for neither circumcision nor uncircumcision profits anything. He says, the only thing that counts is faith expressing itself through love. And I've pondered that and said, now, that little phrase, faith expressing itself through love, what is the connection? Faith, you can't see my faith. You can only accept whether or not I say I believe God or I believe in Jesus Christ. But the demonstration that my faith is in Jesus Christ is seen through my acts of love. Whether or not I love you and how I relate to you. In 1 Timothy 1, he said to Timothy, the end of the commandment is this, love out of a pure heart. Love. That's what it's all about. He says that we ought to owe no one anything except the debt of love. That's one debt that we can never totally discharge. We'll always owe that, and I'll always owe you the debt of love. In the 70s, there was a popular hit song, and you probably heard it in the we're of the age group, most of us, that can remember it. It says, what the world needs now is love, sweet love. And it is never more true today. In our increasingly dysfunctional family context and our hate-filled world. You know, people just shoot someone else that they don't even know. They'll just drive by and shoot at a car. Had a young lady who was a friend of my niece's when they went to college up at Bethel College in Minnesota, and we got to know her also, and she was in Dallas, I think it was a couple of years ago, driving home one night. Someone drove by, she'll never know who, she doesn't know, and perhaps we'll never find out, and drove by and just shot through the car. Fortunately, she's been healed from that. I mentioned George Barna in closing on Monday, the market researcher, and in his book, I think it is The Frog in the Kettle, speaking about the future, he said, one outcome of the changing nature of family relationships is that we're seeking emotional gratification from sources outside of the home. The majority of Americans feel that they do not have enough close friends. Because of factors that have led to rampant loneliness and emotional emptiness show no signs of dissipating, it is unlikely that Americans will feel any less lonely 10 years from now than they do today. Tangible results of loneliness are alcoholism, drug abuse, physical abuse, suicide, depression, sexual promiscuity, premarital sex. All these are likely to increase. Last year, after I had talked with someone, it dawned on me to reflect that during the course of that year, I had had conversations, meaningful, in-depth conversations, with five men, ages 28 to 54, who are all hurting from experiencing the lack of love, or I should say, not experiencing love from their fathers. I remember one of these men, age 50 years old, he was going to go see his parents who lived in a different city. He had been in counseling and therapy that year and had come to discover some things and acknowledge some truths in his life. And he was going to see his dying mother, dying of cancer, and his father, to hear them say to him what he has never heard them say, I love you. And I said, what if they don't? And they didn't. And they're both passed away. To love our neighbors ourselves is never more needed, never more relevant. So I'd like to share three thoughts in the time that we have remaining from the Bible about demonstrating love for others. And in case you're one of those for whom morning comes too soon and it takes you a few cups of coffee and until 10 o'clock or so to get with it for the day, while you're still with us, let me just tell you what the three thoughts are, and then you can talk intelligently later on, even though you might doze off here and there. The three thoughts are, love accepts, love builds, and love covers. Go back to your ABCs, and that's what it is. Love accepts, love builds, and love covers. Now, let me just ask you quickly. Jesus says to love our neighbors. Now, in your mind, who do you think Jesus is talking about when he says, love your neighbor? Feel free to express. There are no right answers. I'd just like to hear what you think. Your wife, Betty. Pardon, someone down here. Everyone, wherever the Lord takes you. Other thoughts, other ways of expressing it. Good. Another thought. All of mankind. Very specific. Those people we can't get along with, in case you didn't hear over there. Hey, you've got the picture. And we could end right here. But I've worked too hard and worried too much about this. Romans 15:7. From this great book and letter that the Apostle Paul had written, we find a thought here, and I want to major in verse 7, but verse 1 and 2 gives it context. It says, we who are strong, Romans 15, 1 and 2, we who are strong ought to bear with the failings of the weak and not to please ourselves. Each of us should please his neighbor for his good, to build him up. For even Christ did not please himself. And then verse 7. Accept one another then, just as Christ accepted you, in order to bring praise to God. Accept one another. Just as Christ accepted you. Accept means to take to oneself. It signifies a special interest on the part of the receiver, suggesting a welcome. One of the courtesies that Gloria and I observe and talk about, that we observe in traveling to African countries, is when you meet someone, the first thing they say to you is, welcome. Welcome. It's a nice thought. It's saying, I welcome you. I receive you. I respect you as one created in God's image. I will treat you courteously. I will not be prejudiced against you. I may not condone your lifestyle. I may not agree with what you're doing or with your beliefs, but I accept you as a person created in the image of God. This word, accept one another, is the same word that Paul used when he wrote to Philemon, Philemon 17. And if you're wondering what verse, you know, those of you not familiar with this book, it only has one chapter. So they don't give a chapter. So it's just Philemon 17. And Onesimus was a runaway slave. And the last Philemon knew of this young man was he just one of his slaves in his estate. Then Paul was a very good friend and dear friend of Philemon. Onesimus had become a believer under Paul's ministry. They shared the same prison cell. And Onesimus became a believer, and he was now being released, and Paul wrote Philemon and says, you know, Philemon, I want you to welcome him back, receive him back, accept him back in the same way that you accept me. This slave, this runaway slave, you only knew him as a slave back then. But now, he's become a dear brother, and says, receive him the same way. That's the word accept. And Paul is saying, accept this person. He was not even in your socioeconomic class. But accept him the same way you accept me. See, how does Jesus accept us? Have you thought about that? How did Jesus accept you? Were you so close to Jesus in character, in lifestyle, in attitudes and everything, it was very easy for him to accept you? You know, we're so distant from him, it's night and day. And he accepted us unconditionally. Just like the song says, just as I am. Just as I am. Just as we are. He loved us and accepted us. I like reading in the Gospels. And one of the things I try to observe is how Jesus related to the people in his world. How did Jesus accept people? And Paul says, just as Christ accepted you. And, you know, think of in Mark 1, 40 and 41, you see this leper coming to Jesus. And he knelt before him and said to Jesus, if you will, you can make me clean. Now, Jesus could have just spoken. Jesus could have just willed. But you remember what Jesus did? He touched him. This guy was one of the untouchables. This guy was one of those, the Old Testament says, when you have the disease that you have, you go around in torn clothes and you shout, unclean, unclean, so people would know to avoid you. They were the untouchables. But Jesus touched him. Mother Teresa says, and you think, you'd look at this little woman, you think, you know, it's easy for her. You know, some people just have no problems being around lepers and people like that. But no, it isn't so for her. She says, no, I wouldn't touch a leper for £1,000. But I willingly cure him for the love of God. That's what drives her. It's not because it's any easier for her than it is for me. And I wonder today, who might be the lepers of our society today? I wonder if it's not the people with AIDS. And how do you relate to them? Do you come at them with a condemning attitude to say, served you just right? One of our staff members, I just learned yesterday, is back from the field, waiting out with his brother, who is dying of AIDS. And his brother's friend is also dying of AIDS. Talked to one of our staff yesterday, come from Uganda, is returned from Uganda, and he told me how difficult it was to go to one of the hospitals to meet one of their key girls who was in there for AIDS, and how he couldn't recognize her because of the medication he had given her had just peeled her skin, and she was not a black African woman, but just pink. He didn't even recognize her. And when the mother said, you know, what we need now is we need 50 cents to buy some orange squash. And would you pray for her? He said it took him everything just to reach out and touch her. Pray for her. Jesus touched the leper. And he's in us today, and he wants to touch some of these people. Different from us, different in their lifestyle. And you keep on reading, and I notice here in Luke chapter 7 and Luke chapter 14, in Luke 7, 36, and Luke chapter 14, you find that a Pharisee invited Jesus to his home for dinner. And you know what? Jesus went. Now, remember the Pharisees? In fact, they were the kinds of people that today we have a little phrase, and if we want to speak about someone being hypocritical, we speak of them being like a Pharisee. Now, these people had the same Bible that Jesus had, the same law. But they believed differently from Jesus. And Jesus didn't agree with them. In fact, he would challenge their teachings, and he would go head to head with them. But this guy invited Jesus to his home for dinner. And Jesus took the invitation and went. Would you go? If someone who believed differently from you and believed so militantly and aggressively. But Jesus went. And you think of all the people who don't believe like you do. Maybe you're a Baptist and they're Pentecostal. Or maybe you're Presbyterian. Or maybe, let's take an extreme. You know, a Mormon or a Jehovah's Witness were to invite you to their home for dinner. Would you go? See, life becomes very simple if your only purpose in life is to exalt Jesus Christ. See, you know, I'll go. And I can accept this person. I may not agree with what they believe, but I may be able to exalt Jesus Christ with them. And you look in Luke chapter 15, verse 1, and you see here a very interesting thing. He says, now the tax collectors and sinners were all gathering around to hear him. But the Pharisees and the teachers of the law muttered, this man welcomes sinners. He accepts sinners. He receives sinners. And he eats with them. This guy, he can't be spiritual. And Jesus says, you call me a glutton, a drunkard, and a friend of tax collectors and sinners. That was the reputation that Jesus had. That's what the religious people called him, because the religious people would have nothing to do with sinners. But not Jesus. He says, hey, these are the people who need me. You know, that's a reputation I'd like to have. And it takes time. And it takes the accepting and the non-condemning attitude of Jesus to relate to the people who are unbelievers and whose lifestyle may be very, very different from ours. But we don't relate to them. Most believers have a hit-and-run relationship with unbelievers. We come to them when we have to associate with them at work. But if they invite us to come to their parties, well, we have a million, I'd love to, but I'm busy tonight. We were going to go to this service, and we have another excuse the next time they invite us. And it's not because we can't make the time, but because we have a wrong understanding of separation, of not loving the world, and of being separate from the world. Instead of separating from the values of the world and embracing the people of the world, we embrace the values of the world and separate from the people of the world. And the unbelievers are confused, and they see no difference in us. We have a come-to mentality with the believers. You come to our service. Billy Graham is going to be in town. Will you come to this meeting? We have a special speaker. We're going to have a breakfast. Will you come to it? But we don't have a go-to mentality, which is what Jesus says. Go into all the world. You go. And that's where he was. He was among the people. I asked a businessman who had come to Christ. He is an entrepreneur, Harvard-trained lawyer on the Economic Development Council of his city. I said, Mike, you've just recently come to Christ. Tell me, what does it take for us to reach people like you and your friends? And he quickly answered. He says, first of all, among evangelicals, there are no models. And he says, secondly, evangelicals don't live integrated lives. They tell you about what they believe, but how they conduct their lives don't match up. It's inconsistent. And he says, thirdly, evangelicals must stop treating people like their projects. Sobering, but unfortunately right on target. So take a moment. You have a piece of paper? Jot down the name of someone in your world that you feel that, whether it's a believer or unbeliever, but someone that you need to reach out to and you've not been accepting, you've not been welcoming. Whether that's a believer or non-believer, is there someone in your world that you just need to work at accepting? Take a moment, jot that name down. I'll wait before I move on. Might be a relative. Might be a neighbor. Might be a co-worker. But you hit the nail right on when you said, you know, it's a people who, in the place where Jesus sent us, wherever people who cross our paths. Is there someone like that? Okay, secondly, love builds. 1 Corinthians 8:1, Paul was addressing an argument going on, a question. And they said, Paul, you tell us what to do because we can't agree over here. Food offered to idols. Is it okay to eat it or not to eat it? Some say it's okay, some say it's not okay. And Paul's reply was, you know, concerning food offered to idols, we know that all of us possess knowledge. All of us have an opinion about these things. He says, knowledge puffs up, but love builds up. So why don't you focus on love? Love builds up. See, love seeks to win people. not to win arguments. It seeks to build up someone, to seek their interest, to contribute to their well-being, because love serves. 1 John 3:16 to 18 says, "This is how we know what love is. Jesus Christ laid down his life for us, and we ought to lay down our lives for our brothers. If anyone has material possessions and sees his brother in need, but has no pity on him, how can the love of God be in him?" Dear children, let us not love with words or tongue, but with actions and in truth. See, how, look at the scriptures and say, how did Jesus build up these people? You remember Nathanael, you find him in John 1. This was a man that when Andrew went to him and says, you know, we have found the Messiah, the one of whom Moses and the prophets wrote, Jesus of Nazareth. Do you remember how Nathanael answered? You remember? That's right. Can anything good come out of Nazareth? I mean, kind of skeptical, sarcastic. And Andrew didn't argue with him. Andrew just said, why don't you come and see? When Jesus saw Nathanael, first time he's meeting him in person, this guy comes to Jesus skeptical, doubtful, maybe even a little sarcastic. What did Jesus say to him? "Behold an Israelite indeed in whom there is no guile." He complimented him right away. He didn't say, "Oh, so you're the guy who thinks nothing good can come out of Nazareth." No. How about the man in Mark 5? They call him the demoniac of the Gerasenes. This guy, they said that he was a man with an evil spirit. He had come out from the tombs. That's where he lived, in the cemeteries. He lived in the tombs. No one could bind him anymore, not even with a chain. For he had often been chained hand and foot, but he tore the chains apart and broke the irons on his feet. No one was strong enough to subdue him. And this man was an outcast. Would you say his life had much significance? Probably not. In fact, when he was healed, and the people of the town came back and they saw this man in his right mind, instead of rejoicing, they said to Jesus, "Could you leave our city? We've lost a whole herd of pigs here." The pigs were more valued than this man was. But Jesus healed this man, and this man became the evangelist of 10 cities. He wanted to go with Jesus, but Jesus said, "No, you'd do more good by going back to your family and to your friends." You see, they would know, if he went to another city, they would know who this guy was, but the other people, they would know what he was like and the impact he would have. And Jesus gave his life significance, and he made a permanent difference. This guy, whose life was a mess, Jesus put a message in its place, and he went around with significance. And you know, how did Jesus build up Peter in that chapter in Luke 20:22? Jesus knew that Peter was going to deny him. Luke 22:31 and 32, Jesus says, "You know, Simon, Simon, and Satan has desired to have you to me, sift you as wheat." And he didn't say, "You know, and I know it's going to happen, Peter. And with all the words that you have said, you're going to let me down." He says, "No." He says, "Peter, I have prayed for you, that your faith fail not. And when you're converted, when you're delivered, strengthen your brothers." He gave him hope. And he says, "I have prayed for you." Peter. You know, Nicodemus, he came to Jesus. What did Jesus do? How did Jesus build him up? Remember? What comes to your mind from that conversation? In fact, a phrase we use very often. That's out of that passage comes this phrase, you must be born again. But Jesus took the time and conversed with this man and talked with him in a way that he could understand as a teacher of Israel, perhaps a head of a rabbinic school, and helped him to understand about eternal life. Jesus was always seeking to build up the people, serving them. And if we were reading further in Luke 7, we would have seen that this widow of Nain, Jesus hadn't perhaps met her before, but there was a funeral procession. She was a widow, and she had lost her only son. And it says in Luke 7 that when Jesus saw her, I like that little phrase as I was rereading it this morning. He says, when the Lord saw her, his heart went out to her. His heart went out to her. And he said, don't cry. And he used the power that he had. He used the resources that he had to bring her son back to life and give him back to her. Now, we don't have that resources, but what resources do we have that can be used to serve and build up people in your world? Just quickly, just off the top of your head, what resources can you think of? The Bible, okay, the message of the Bible. Pardon? Kindness. Compassion. Ourselves. The experiences you have. Listening ear. We have each other. Time. Other thoughts? It's amazing. Our home. All the resources you have. And you could perhaps, if we had more time, you could add to that list very specifically, very practically. You know, someone mentioned time. I meet with a builder here in town. We began meeting 3 years ago, and I had told him that I like to help people start to read the Bible and so they could understand about what life with Jesus is all about. And he was interested. And first time we met, I said, tell me where you are so that I won't be redundant. He says, well, you know, I've got this big hole in my life, and I don't know if Jesus is the one who can fill it. And he said, I've been to church about 4 times in my life. He was about 45. His wife later told me, I think he exaggerated. But one of the comments he made to me sometime later was how much he appreciated our getting together, because he says, no one has ever made time just for me. Time. Someone mentioned a listening ear. It's been said that everyone needs to be listened to. Has a need to be understood and have a need to be taken seriously. So, a listening ear. You know, one of the things we have that doesn't cost us anything, but for some reason we just don't do it. Someone asked Mother Teresa, tell us something that will help us to live our lives better. She was expecting something profound from Mother Teresa. Tell us something that will help us to live our lives better. Mother Teresa says, smile at each other. Just practice smiling at each other. Jesus said of Peter, I have prayed for you. And prayer, says S.D. Gordon, is the greatest thing that anyone can do for God or for man. And that's what Jesus did for Peter. Pray for people. As you become aware of a need, pray for them. Pray. Don't put it off till the next morning when you meet God. Pray right then. I talked to a friend last night and said, I'm going to have surgery on Monday. I says, I'll pray for you. Knowing that I may forget on Monday, I prayed right then after I hung up the phone. So, someone says ourselves. And in 1 Thessalonians 2:8, it's a very good summary. It says, for you became very dear unto us, so we were willing to have imparted unto you not the gospel of God only, but also our own life, our very selves. And that's what Paul wanted. He not only gave them love and gave them the gospel, but gave them his very life. So, you might jot down later on in the morning or maybe in your discussion group one person and one idea that you can use to serve and build up that person. Just one idea, one person. Lastly, love covers. 1 Peter 4, 7 and 8 tells us that love covers a multitude of sin. It covers a multitude of sin. And it is echoing what the writer of Proverbs says in Proverbs 17:9. It says, "He who covers an offense seeks love, but he who repeats and harps on a matter separates even close friends." You keep bringing up an offense rather than covering it and forgiving it, and like God, you bury it in the depths of the sea. But if you keep bringing it up, you separate even your very best friends. Love covers. It doesn't condone sin, but it accepts the sinner. Love seeks to restore. It seeks to reconcile, to heal. I met with a young man who was serving in our ministries overseas, and he was sent home by the team because of some sexual impropriety. But the first time I learned about it, I talked with the people who came to tell me about it. I said, you know, we're going to approach this with a view to restore and to reconcile. And when he met with me yesterday, that's what he wanted to know. Where am I? I said, is there anything you want to know from me? He said, yes, what's the possibility that I'll have of going back also, you know, how am I viewed now? And I said, you know, from the very outset when I heard about this, our view is as long as you're repentant, then we're aiming for restoration and reconciliation. You see, we have a view that when we hear of somebody's sin, then we become condemning. And we also, in fact, the bigger the person, the more we want to broadcast it. And the more we want to be critical of them. But love covers. Love seeks to forgive as Christ forgave. And it doesn't keep uncovering the sin. It provides an environment for expressing forgiveness and the healing of Jesus. I love that picture in John 8. You know, you'll probably read in the Bible that this little segment is not in most of the reliable manuscripts or the most recent manuscripts. But I think it's very characteristic of Jesus anyway that when they brought this woman who was caught in the act of adultery. See, and this was the Pharisees' way. They want to broadcast it. You remember Jesus? He didn't even look the woman in the face. With sensitivity, he just knelt down. He didn't even look at her. And he says, okay, whoever among you has not sinned, let him cast the first stone. And they all slipped away. And Jesus realized they were all gone, and just a woman was there. And then he looked at her and says, has no one condemned you? No one, sir. He says, neither do I condemn you. Go and sin no more. Did he condone her sin? No. Did he agree with it? No. But he treated it with sensitivity and with forgiveness. He sought to restore her, to reconcile her. The disciples, Matthew 28:26-56 says, when they came to arrest Jesus, all the disciples fled. They forsook him and fled. But when Jesus, after his resurrection, came to be with them, he didn't say, you're the guys, what happened to you guys? Where were you when I needed you? No, he said, you know what? I want you to go into all the world and make disciples of every nation. He's going to trust them who abandon him. He says, you're all I've got. And I'm going to put this mission for the redemption of the world and this message right in your hands. You talk about confidence. You talk about love covering. Is there someone who has hurt you? Or someone whose sin you know about that just offends you? Maybe you're not the one who is offended, but what this person does so offends you. Can you aim to seek to be a peacemaker and a reconciler and a forgiver? Augustine of the 4th century says, love describes the activity of one who is determined in his heart to be a lover. And his love is not in word only. It results in loving treatment of another person. Purpose to love people, the people in your world, where you live, where you work, where you play, as you love yourself. To love them as Christ wants to love them through you. You know, it's the most liberating, it's the most peace-giving, it's the most empowering choice that you'll make. To purpose that I am going to love you no matter who you are, no matter what you're like, no matter what you have done, no matter how you'll treat me, I'm going to love you with the love of Christ. And it will be totally disarming to them. Father, teach us, we pray, to love others as you love us. Teach us, we pray, to accept others, to build them up, to cover their sin, as you do for us. In the name of Jesus, we pray.